This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Brian Ballow joins me live in studio. He is one of the Backstory History guys at backstoryradio.org, and he is also a member of the Corcoran Department of History at the University of Virginia. Brian, it's so good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Coy.
Now, we are going to talk about vitriolic political speech in America, and we'll hopefully explore that, answer the question, or at least explore it, is this anything new? But to set up our conversation, let's play a clip here from your program that you do that's heard on public radio stations around the country with co-hosts Peter Onuf and Ed Ayers, also historians, American historians. And this clip includes a conversation between those two talking about this very subject, right?
That's right.
So we'll play this clip and then we'll talk. It's 4:39.
Partisan polemics and trash talk go back to the very beginning of American political history. In fact, you might say it's not just the noise surrounding politics. In some ways, it is the politics. And it's essential. I think we ought to keep in mind that what distinguishes our system and makes the Constitution work is that we have provided for regime change through internal mechanisms. And to make that meaningful to the American people, we have to have political parties that are able to articulate conflicting views. Because if we're all agreeing on everything, then what's the point of getting involved?
Well, see, let me model that behavior by disagreeing with you. if this is so intrinsic to what we're doing, then why the heck isn't it in the Constitution? You know, why'd they have to make it up after hours, as it were?
Well, we have to think about what the Constitution does. The Constitution is static by itself. It provides for mechanisms that have to be vitalized. There has to be energy and life in them. Nobody knew this at the beginning because there was a dream, a fantasy, that all we needed to do was get those mechanisms and the machine would run of itself without the need for popular political action. But in a way, once the genie was out of the bottle, once the people had gotten involved in the revolution itself, and then in the ratification struggle over the Constitution, there was no putting them back in that bottle.
You know, and I would add that partisanship along party lines can actually be a constructive thing, because let's think about an example from the 19th century when partisanship declined, the partisanship between the Democrats and the Whigs, right, the two national parties, in which you'd have this conflict that Peter's talking about in every community in America. So whether you're in New England or in the Midwest or in the South or out West, people are fighting with each other and their neighbors. But when that fades away, as soon as the Whig Party begins to decline, then the divisions between Northerners and Southerners reasserts itself.
That's a great point.
And people said at the time, look out, you know, if we lose the two-party system, which channels conflict into ways that can be resolved at each election, and replace it with sectional conflict for which there's no resolution other than war, there's no telling what's going to happen. And, of course, what did happen was war.
Wouldn't you say, Ed, that in your century, in the period of the so-called second party system, you could be violently opposed to your neighbor in partisan terms and believe that your neighbor voting against you was risking the future of the republic, yet there were other contexts in which you'd imagine yourself in solidarity with your neighbor, maybe even that whole sectional thing you were just talking about? It's the fact that you could both be opposed to people and identify with them at the same time. It sounds like a paradox. And it seems to me that that kind of locally based two-party system enabled Americans, in effect, to have it both ways during this period.
Yeah, and that reminds us of an important role that the parties play, which is creating the machinery of local government that the founders did not really conceive all the way down to the ground, right? So what you find is that, why does it matter if your neighbor is a Democrat and you're a Whig? Well, because somebody's going to be handing out a partisan position. Somebody's going to become the tax collector.
Yeah,
somebody's
going to
be the editor of the newspaper.
Yeah. Someone's going to decide where the road goes.
Yeah, exactly. And so people have a reason that's not just hatred or policy difference to sort of disagree. But when it's over, the idea is you shake hands and you go on because You have to, because you're neighbors.
And because there's going to be another election, right? So the game continues. That's the important thing, to believe
exactly
that the game's going to go on.
It's 442. You've been listening to an extended clip from Backstory Radio. It's backstoryradio.org with the American History guys, Peter Onuf and Ed Ayers. Brian Ballow is co-host, and he joins me live in studio. Brian, before we take a break, and then we'll pick up with this very topic when we get back, this very subject of heated political rhetoric, not just heated, but vitriolic, mean-spirited political rhetoric in the history of American discourse. Give us your elevator speech on it before we take a break here, and where your quick observation, and then we'll flesh it out when we get back.
The elevator speech is, in an ideal world, we'd all be civil, but I'd rather have vitriolic speech than no speech at all, or than to cover over basic differences between Americans and not have the opportunity to debate them in public.
And if ballots don't work, bullets will.
It's 4:46. I'm Corey Barefoot. This is Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA. We're talking with U.S. historian Brian Ballow, one of the American History guys at BackstoryRadio.org. And we just heard some of that vitriolic political speech from Glenn Beck, and then Florida radio host Joyce Kaufman, which I think will go down in history. If ballots don't work, then bullets will. And for me, that's really what we're talking about here. It's this kind of stuff. It's somebody getting on with millions of people listening and saying, I want to kill someone. Or somebody getting up with all, you know, millions of people listening and saying, go get your guns. You know, if the election doesn't go the way you want it, then get your gun and we'll solve our problems that way. Have we been here before, or is that particular appeal to gun violence something new?
Oh, no. It's something very old. You know, Coy, congressmen used to bring guns onto the floor of the House. They used to be well armed. Partisans have been threatening violence as part of the rhetoric. And of course, you know that Americans used to have duels and kill each other over political differences, although they were usually expressed as, you know, personal insult. But if you trace them, they often went back to partisan differences. So it depends on how far back you want to go. However, even though I love history, we do know that people tend to pay more attention to things they can remember themselves, remembered history. And it is true that the rhetoric has become much more heated in my own lifetime. I think that's attributable to several things, none of which I think we should be terribly worried about, and you and I probably disagree with this. Now, mind you, I don't sanction the kind of language in the clips that you played, and I don't think that way, and I wouldn't use that kind of language, especially on the air.
But you would defend somebody's right to get up and say it.
I absolutely defend their right. I think that we as citizens, if we oppose that, we need to not listen to their shows and perhaps even let their sponsors know that we're offended by it.
I totally agree with that. My whole point is, where are the leaders of a particular party in coming out and saying, I think you went too far there? You know, you don't speak for me. Where's the Republican leaders telling O'Reilly and Glenn Beck, hey, you're going too far. You know, you're hurting us all. You're dragging us all down, in other words. By doing this, they don't do that. They sort of sit back on their hands. And
well, it's interesting, Coy, that you just said the leaders of the Republican Party. You didn't say Republican, but the implication is that Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly are the leaders of the Republican Party. And of course, you know that formally they're not. You know that they're journalists, if that.
Yeah,
They're talking heads, and so. Let me, you know, since you pay me the big bucks here to be the historian, let me put this in historical perspective and point to two things that I think have contributed to the heated rhetoric, allowed personalities to make statements like we heard.
Yeah.
The first is the proliferation of media outlets. When I was growing up, when you were growing up even, we got our politics, at least our electronic politics, from those three stations, those three networks. And we had Calm and Cool personalities like Walter Cronkite. We had father-like figures that we could trust. They needed to be like that. They needed to get at least a third of the entire country because they were really the only game in town. And a couple of things happened. One was technological. We got satellite technology. We got digital technology. We got a whole range of media. We, of course, today we have the blogosphere.
Yeah.
And so somebody can get an audience that matters in today's stratified world and only have really, you know, a very low percentage of the people out there. That allows them to cater to the more radical fringes of both sides, frankly.
Yeah.
The other thing that's happened, and I'm really summarizing quickly here, is much more parity between the two parties. Democrats basically held the majority for the entire middle third of this country, and it was a pretty strong majority. This is not to say they didn't lose the presidency. You know, I haven't lost my mind. I know that Nixon was a Republican, but Congress was Democratic for the most part, and the establishment was Democratic, and there was a significant plurality of people who identified themselves as Democrats. Today, the parties are much more evenly divided. When you get an evenly divided electorate, you get somebody who's going to want to kind of get the edge and really rile up, mobilize a portion of that base to get out there because it really might make the difference in that election. And what you have is a scene that looks a lot like the late 19th century today, where, you know, Republicans and Democrats went after each other. They used all kinds of vitriolic rhetoric, and elections were like wars. They were like mobilizing the troops, and they actually talked in those terms. Forget about bullets. They talked about entire troops, battalions, you name it. And it was all out war. And then just throw in one final thing if we have time.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Brian Ballow. He's one of the history guys at backstoryradio.org and a member of the Department of History at the University of Virginia. Go right ahead.
You know, after the late 19th century, a lot of people like me, kind of fuzzy-headed professor type, said, you know, this politics should be, it shouldn't be so militaristic. It shouldn't be so vitriolic. It's really getting ugly out there. This should be we should have a higher level of discourse. We should have places like the Miller Center of Public Affairs where we can debate in a very civil way, kind of views from each side. And they made politics, quote, educational. They raised it to a higher level. And you know what happened? You're a good student of politics. Well, you know what happened when they did that?
What?
People stopped showing up at the ballot box. And you know what people like me said, those professors in the 20s? You know what they said? Oh, my God, why aren't people voting? We need to figure out how to get people interested in politics again. And one of the things that has happened, I think, with the rise of social issues and cultural issues, issues like abortion, issues like, you know, bilingual education in the schools. People have found a connection between politics and their personal lives again, and they've become animated about it. So I think the price we're paying for discussing a broad range of issues that people are worried about is some of that animation, some of that vitriol is spilling over into the public commons. And I don't condone it. I don't endorse it, but I think...
But it's nothing new in American history.
It's definitely nothing new in American history, although, as I said, it has increased in my lifetime, in the last 50 years.
Yeah. We're talking with Brian Ballow, American historian. It's 4:54. And before I get criticized for only picking on the right here, we should remember that just a few decades ago, it was the left who was bombing buildings and taking over buildings and really being even more militaristic and literally picking up guns and using them and bombs. And also, if you want to keep going even further back, it was Thomas Jefferson who said to James Madison, for God's sake, and this was in reference to Alexander Hamilton, for God's sake, take up your pen, select the most striking heresies, and cut Hamilton to pieces in the face of the public. Love that line. That said, it has been the conservative right who've been saying for years, oh, it's all the rap music and the lyrics and the sex and the violence on television and the wardrobe malfunction. And by their own standard, they have not only said that all of this stuff is debasing and corrupting society, they've argued that it literally leads to violence, except when it comes to political rhetoric. That's where they say, no, 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 but that doesn't. But all the other stuff does.
Well, my personal view is that it takes more than rhetoric to lead people to violence. I think that Americans are genuinely angry about a number of matters. I'm not sure they always blame the right people, and I'm not sure that talk radio hosts, for instance, always channel that anger in the right directions. I'm bothered by the, you know, since we got rid of the fairness doctrine back in the 1987, those talk radio hosts who have taken advantage of that venue have been disproportionately conservative. On the other hand, you have to give them credit. They're much more entertaining than progressive talk radio hosts. I listen to...
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
I listen to both sides, and my own views don't matter. The fact is that the right-wingers are just... They just make for better radio, yeah. Period. So I'm not surprised that they have millions of listeners, politics aside.
Speaking of better radio, it's backstoryradio.org is the website. Check it out. Check out the program. Brian Ballow, thank you, sir, for being here.
Thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.